Every one of us, we are all hardwired for peak performance. We are built to go big. And there are a lot of scientific reasons for it, but it also turns out that not going big, not using the system the way it was designed to be used, not living up to our full potential, not going big is bad for us, in short.
Hi, everyone. Drew Brode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today, we're talking with award-winning journalist Stephen Kotler, who is a specialist and an expert in the world of peak performance. If you want to know how to take the impossible and make it possible, this podcast is for you. Stay tuned. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Thrive Market, one of my favorite resources for getting healthy foods delivered right to my doorstep. Who doesn't love that? When it comes to what I eat, I'm super intentional. You guys know this, you listen to the podcast. So it's extremely important for me to know exactly what I'm buying. So I always take a deep dive into the ingredients and the company practices before adding anything new to my kitchen. My fiance knows this. With Thrive Market, I've been able to find tons of the brands I trust in one spot, like Four Sigmatic, Hugh Kitchen, Artisana, and so many others. Forget this, up to 25 to 50% off the retail price. You just choose from a 1 month or 12 month membership to take advantage of their amazing deals. And by the way, if you're not into it, you have 30 days to cancel. Thrive Market has thousands of products, including gluten-free, dairy-free, organic, paleo, fair trade, you name it, they have it. You can get all the healthy ingredients and kitchen essentials and even clean home and body care products. They also have grass-fed beef and sustainable seafood options. So it's super easy to plan ahead for healthy meals and get them delivered right again to your doorstep. Right now, Thrive Market is offering my listeners an amazing deal. When you sign up for a new membership, you'll receive a free gift, And anytime you spend more than $49, you'll get free carbon neutral shipping from one of their zero waste warehouses. You get to pick the gift. The zero waste happens automatically. Thrive Market makes my life so much easier. I know you're going to love it as much as I do. So I set up a special code. Just go to thrivemarket.com/brokenbrain. That's thrivemarket.com/brokenbrain. Sign up and start filling up your cart. You'll see the credit automatically deducted at checkout. Okay, now back into today's episode. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Pruitt, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. And this podcast today is all about living more, getting the most out of life by stepping into peak performance. And our guest today is Stephen Kotler, one of the world's leading experts on peak performance and an award-winning journalist. He's also the founder and executive director of the Flow Research Collective. He's written 12 books, including the national bestsellers, The Future is Faster Than You Think, The Rise of Superman, Stealing Fire, Abundance and Bold, and his latest book, The Art of the Impossible, a Peak Performance Primer. His work has been nominated for two Pulitzer Prizes, and has been translated to more than 40 languages. And he's appeared in more than 100 publications, including all the ones you know and love, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Wired, Time, and more. Stephen, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
I'd love to define what impossible is by starting off with this core idea, the difference between small I impossible and capital I impossible, as you outline inside the book.
Yeah, for sure. So I would say that I've spent most of my adult life studying those moments in time when the impossible came possible. And what I mean by that is those moments where that stuff, which has never been done before and we believe would never be done, gets done, right? And this could be athletic impossibles, like a 4-minute mile, or cultural impossibles, Rosa Parks sitting at the front of the bus, or genius Einsteinian impossibles like the theory of relativity, those kinds of things. But the book, The Art of Impossible, is, while it's a book of lessons sort of learned from studying people who've accomplished what I call capital I impossible, It's meant to be used by anybody who's interested in small I impossible. And small I impossible is all that stuff that we believe is impossible for ourselves. Simple example that I give in the book is I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio in the 70s in a, you know, blue collar steel milker mill town. And I wanted to be a writer. I mean, from the time I was very, very young, I wanted to be a writer. It was about the rough equivalent of wanting to be an elf, right? It was like, I woke up one morning and said, Mom, Dad, when I grow up, I'm going to be an elf or a dwarf. Right. Like, it was completely fictional. I didn't know any writers. I didn't know how to be a writer. I didn't know how to become a writer other than sort of putting words together in a straight line. I really didn't know how to proceed. That's a small I impossible. What it means is there's no clear path between point A or point B, and statistically, lousy odds of success. And there's lots of small I impossibles in our lives. Rising out of poverty, overcoming deep trauma, figuring out how do you get paid for what you love. Right, what you're actually passionate about, becoming world class in anything, you know, it could be stamp collecting. That's another impossible. I think for a lot of people, the very first impossible that most of us go after is how do I get a girlfriend or a boyfriend? You know, when we're teenagers and we have no idea how to pull that off. And the point of all this is, if you're interested in capital I impossible, that which has never been done. In 30 years of studying the people who have accomplished just that, I've never seen anybody or met anybody who set out to accomplish capital I impossible. I have met a ton of people who set out to accomplish small I impossible, and then they went to another one, another small I, and eventually you end up accomplishing capital I impossible along the way. That's usually how it works. So well, it's a basic book on peak performance.
And it's a fantastic one. You mentioned your life growing up and some of those first impossibles that we uncover as we're starting off our journeys as young children and then into early adulthood. I've heard you share in other interviews that one of your first experiences with the impossible being real and connecting the dots with skill set was exposure to magic, specifically your brother.
Yeah. So when I have a younger brother who's a couple years younger than me, and I was 8 or 9, and my brother had come home from a friend's house, and you know, he sort of like walks in the front door and he reaches into his pocket and pulls out this bright red spun ball. Now, if you've seen magic before, somebody taking a bright red spun ball, putting it in their hand and making it disappear, that doesn't seem very impossible. I had never seen magic before. I'd never seen close-up or prestidigitation or anything like that. And literally, my brother walked in and he did this thing that looked completely impossible. And it was this weird moment where I was like, well, wait a minute. My brother's not magic. Like, I know he's not magic. And so if he's not magic, then this thing that looks impossible, there's got to be a skill set on the underside. And there was. I dove into professional magic. I spent 10 years of my life earning my living, basically. I worked from the time I was 11 on through college as a magician. And the interesting thing is, in magic, you see the same thing. Like, you see absolutely impossible things that are mind-bendingly impossible. And underneath, there's always a skill set and a process. And it turns out it's not just magic, right? It's everything. Whenever we see the impossible become possible, there's always a skill set, a process, and a progression that's invisible from the outside.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest myths around impossible that people have, who especially maybe they've heard of the flow state work, maybe even been aware of some of your research in that space and writing in some of that space. But when it comes to impossible, there's this myth that's there that I was not born that way, so therefore it's always a little bit out of our reach. And your central message inside of this book is that we all start off average. No one starts off extraordinary. It's something that we can practice and begin to get better at.
It's a skill set, all of it. Yeah, I say this in the book, and I've spent my life studying extraordinary people who have done extraordinary things. And nobody I met has started out extraordinary. In fact, the first group of people I studied, where when I came to this work, I started out studying action adventure sport athletes in the 1990s, which was is now spoken about as the great era of impossible, where literally more things that we believed, I mean, we believed they were physically impossible. The human body could not withstand the force kind of thing. And over and over and over and over and over again, that these things were being, you know, falling in every action sport you could possibly imagine. And I was, you know, as a journalist at the start of my career, this was one of the things I was covering. And I always, you know, it's one thing when you sort of see something on a screen, right? When it's Laird Hamilton surfing a 100-foot wave and you know, wow, it took us 1,000 years to get here to this point. Like that's much work sort of goes into it. And yet it looks, you know, it looks like the most insane thing. In fact, Laird Hamilton on a 60-foot wave is a really good example of sort of what we're talking about. He said this to me once very early on when I first met him. He said, you know, people look at me on a 50-foot wave. He was 33 at the time I first met him, and I was about 27. And he said, you know, they look at me, they see me, I'm 33 years old, and I'm on a 50-foot wave, and they think, oh my God, no way, that's totally impossible. I could never do that. He said, and what they miss is me at 3 years old on a 3-foot wave, and 4 years old on a 4-foot wave, and 5 years old on a 5-foot wave. And they missed me last week surfing a 49.5-foot wave. So I'm showing up today, and to me, I'm thinking, well, this wave is 6 inches bigger than the last one you surf, and really you're not pushing yourself very hard, are you? And everybody else is looking at it and going, oh my God, that's totally impossible. How could I do that? And you can't see everything that came before. So from the outside, it very much does look that way.
I want to touch on another part of your hero's journey, which is also part of that, you know, small I impossible that I think a lot of listeners in this podcast could relate to. And that's in the topic of health. You've written a whole book on this called West of Jesus, but you document and chronicle your experience with Lyme disease. And in a way, your, I'll just use for lack of a better term, your battle with Lyme disease and your process of working through it was also mirrors that idea of a person overcoming what everybody else is saying is impossible. Can you share a little bit about your story with Lyme disease and being diagnosed when you were, I believe, like 30 years old?
Yeah, I was 30 years old. I got Lyme disease. And, you know, Lyme is, if, for those who aren't familiar, it's sort of like the worst flu you've ever had crossed with paranoid schizophrenia. And that's not actually an exaggeration. The most common misdiagnosis with Lyme disease is paranoid schizophrenia. But I was so sick after, you know, I lost everything. I nearly bankrupted myself. The woman I was going to marry, the job, my dream job that I spent 10 years trying to get, all that stuff was gone. And after 3 years, I was a functional about 10% of the time, really a mess. Functional, like I could work, I could function, I could think. I had no use of my brain. I had no short-term memory. I had no long-term memory. My emotions were haywire. I was in so much pain. I could barely walk across a room. And the doctors pulled me off meds. So there was nothing else anybody could do for me, basically. My stomach lining had started bleeding out in reaction to all the different antibiotics they had tried to give me. And nobody knew if I was ever going to get any better. And, I was miserable. I was very suicidal. And in the middle of all this darkness, a friend of mine showed up at my house and demanded that we go surfing, which was the most absurd, ridiculous request ever. I couldn't walk across a room, let alone go surfing. And she would not leave. I mean, hours and hours go by and she's still demanding that we go surfing. And finally, I was like, you know what? What the hell? I mean, like, what is the worst that could happen? Really? And so we went surfing and she put me on a board the size of a Cadillac and, you know, they literally had to carry me out to the lineup. And 30 seconds later, a wave came and muscle memory sort of took over. And I had an instinctive reaction. I saw the wave. I hadn't surfed in about 5 years, but it was a tiny, small wave, friendly, warm water. And I just spun the board around and I paddled twice and I popped up into a profoundly, profoundly altered state of consciousness that the time felt completely magical. Time seemed to be moving in an absolute crawl. I felt like I had panoramic vision, like I could see out of the back of my head. I was surfing incredibly well, which was insane considering I could barely stand. And but the craziest part was I felt great. Like my head was clear for the first time in years. There was no pain in my body for the first time in years. It felt amazing. It felt so good. I caught four more waves. And after the fifth wave, I was just done. I was completely disassembled. They drove me home. They put me in bed. And people had to bring me food for the next kind of 14 days because I couldn't walk to my kitchen. And on the 15th day, I was so compelled by this powerful altered state experience and how good I had felt for those five waves that I caught a ride back to the beach and I did it again. And over the course of about 6 to 8 months, when the only thing I was doing differently in my life was surfing and having these really profound altered state experiences, I got better. I went from about 10% functional to about 80% functional. And, you know, the first question was, what the hell is going on? Right? Surfing is not a known cure for chronic autoimmune conditions. I'm, you know, predominantly a science writer, science guy. And I, you know, I'm not very mystical. And even weirder than the kind of the spontaneous healing element of all this was these wild experiences. And Lyme's only fatal if it gets into your brain. So I was really sure that even though I was feeling better, the fact that I was having these crazy, weird, quasi-mystical experiences in the waves was an absolute sign that the disease had gotten in my brain and I was dying. So I lit out on a giant quest to sort of figure out what the hell had happened to me. And I very quickly figured out, oh, wait a minute, these states of consciousness have names. We call them, you know, scientists call them flow states. And I also, you know, next step in the discovery was, oh, wow, the very state that helped me go from seriously subpar back to normal was helping normal people go all the way up to Superman. In fact, all those action adventure sport athletes I had initially started studying, nobody used the term flow. They had different ways of describing it, different terminology, runner's high, being in the zone, being unconscious. The lingo's everywhere in surfing. They talk about it as the green room or whatnot. And I realized that the same state of consciousness was helping normal people go up all the way up to Superman. And, you know, I've since devoted the rest of my life pretty much to understanding the neurobiology of flow, why this experience has such a huge impact on performance. And, you know, why it sort of sits at the center of the peak performance equation. There's a lot of other stuff going on, but flow's at the dead center of it for the literal reason that it's defined as an optimal state of consciousness, the optimal state of performance, where we feel our best and we perform our best. It's literally how evolution shaped all human beings to perform at their peak. So it was at the center of a big puzzle that the art of the impossible actually kind of, I think, is the first time I've solved all of it.
Yeah, the Art of Impossible builds on all the previous work that was there on flow. So I'd love to, for the audience that's here, that's maybe not as aware of flow, although I would say most people are aware of in periphery, because after your work and a lot of derivative works since that time, there's just been so much more awareness of flow. So I'd love to hear your favorite definition of flow. And I'm curious, has that definition at all changed since you first started writing about it?
So the definition of flow has never changed. The definition of flow is a scientific definition. It is an optimal state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. That's the definition of flow. That hasn't changed. More specifically, because that doesn't get anybody very far, right? Like, what are we actually talking about? And then I'll go into a couple other answers to your question. I'll flesh it out a little bit for you. We're talking about any of those moments of rapt attention and total absorption when you get so focused on the task at hand, so focused on whatever you're doing that everything else just seems to disappear. Action awareness will start to merge. Your sense of self, your sense of self-consciousness will vanish almost completely. Time will dilate, which is a fancy way. It's saying it passes strangely. Sometimes you have that experience I had while surfing. Time will slow down. You get a freeze frame effect. Maybe you've been in a car crash. More frequently, what's much more common is time speeds up and you get so sucked into what you're doing that 5 hours pass by in what feels like 5 seconds. And throughout, all aspects of performance, both mental and physical, go through the roof. So that, by the way, that sort of colloquial definition of flow has not changed as well. And the reason is it's based on how psychologists define flow. Psychologists define flow because the state has six core psychological characteristics, ways the state makes us feel. And I just named a bunch of them. There's complete concentration in the present moment. There's this diminishment of our sense of self. There's time dilation. Time passes strangely. There's this merger of action awareness. There's a couple other things going on. So that's the psychological definition. That has not changed either. The work I do, which is on the neurobiology, right? The actual kind of brain mechanisms underneath all of this. When I started working on flow in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was predominantly defined neurochemically. We thought endorphins were responsible. And there was, you know, the endorphin idea behind runner's high and whatnot. We now know flow is a very, very, very significant, complicated shift in all aspects of neurobiology, meaning there are big changes in neurochemistry. It's not just endorphins. There's five or six other major reward chemicals involved and a whole bunch of other neurochemicals that are also involved. We understand that there are networks in the brain that are involved, like not only just neuroanatomical structures that play a big role in flow, but whole brain networks play a big role in flow. And there's also brain waves involved and so forth. So, and physiology, when I started this work, we had no idea if flow is correlated to any body signals whatsoever. And now, for example, more work needs to be done, but there's some recent works that correlates flow to, has gotten it down to even, you can tell somebody's in flow partially by certain things in facial expressions. So our smile muscles are hyperactive in flow. Flow is an incredibly pleasurable, joyful, ecstatic state. And our smile muscles reflect that. And our frown muscles are actually appear to be paralyzed or downregulated some bit. Though that's not, while nobody ever has a bad time in a flow state, that's not actually what it's a reflection of. People talk about flow as sort of like effortless effort, right? The feeling of being propelled by something bigger than yourself, right? You may be doing really hard work, but it doesn't feel like it. When we frown, that's actually a signal of effort, that you're expending a lot of energy to do the thing that you're doing in flow because it doesn't feel like that, you don't produce that signal. So that's the portion of the definition that has changed, sort of the under the hood, how scientists define flow, that has changed greatly. But as far as kind of the common definitions of flow and how normal people talk about flow, that hasn't shifted at all.
Why has it been, and why do you say it's been traditionally very hard for people to train? Like, why is flow so incredibly hard to train for in the past, the way that we looked at it?
I don't think it's just flow. I think it's the entire suite of peak performance that has been incredibly hard to train, and for the exact same reason. For the past 100 years, peak performance on all levels and flow has been dominated by psychologists. And psychology, as useful and helpful and amazing as it is still metaphor. And I'll give you a really concrete example. So when most people use the word mindset, for example, what they're talking about is attitude towards life. That's actually not what mindset means psychologically. When psychologists talk about mindset, they mean attitude towards learning. But what that, again, is a metaphor. That attitude towards learning gets reflected in things like thalamic gating and top-down filtering from the prefrontal cortex and blah, 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 blah. That's the actual mechanism underneath mindset. And what people are really trying to train is that neurobiological reaction. Flow is impossible to frickin' train. Really, we were terrible at it in the 90s. In the 80s and 90s, it was very hit or miss. And yet my organization, the Flow Research Collective, we train 1,000 people a month on average, and we measure flow using the best tools available pre and post. And on average, we see a 70 to 80% boost in flow. This stuff is not that hard to train when you start with mechanism, but it is very, very hard to train when you start with metaphor.
There's a friend of yours, I believe he's a friend of yours, and he's an acquaintance of mine. He's been on the podcast before, Andrew Huberman, and you've quoted him a few times, and he has this, I'll paraphrase here. He talks about the importance of when it comes to these difficult things that we're working on, it's always crawl, walk, run. How do you think of that in the context of what you were just describing?
Oh, it's the ball game. on a lot of stuff. So what Andrew has said that I think is brilliant, and it would have gone in the book had I heard him say it. He said it to me before the book was done. But unfortunately, he didn't. But he said, look, one of the main things that peak performers know that everybody else misses is that peak performance is always crawl, walk, run. And what happens to most people is that they come to a problem, they come to a situation, they come to a skill set, they come to a whatever, and they say, you know, I really am not so into this crawling shit. In fact, walking, that might be for other people. It is, I want to start at a jog. I'm going to figure out how to jog first. And so they spend a very long time looking for shortcuts into peak performance. And they waste a really long time looking for shortcuts. And peak performers don't bother. They know it's always going to be crawl, walk, run. And as a result, they also know that whatever the thing is, learning is always the same. Learning is an invisible process, right? Our experience of learning anything is I'm bad until I'm better. On the inside, it feels like I suck, I suck, I suck, I suck, I suck. Holy crap, I don't suck so much anymore, right? That's the experience. And what's really happening is we are consciously practicing a skill, passing it over to the unconscious, which is literally memorizing the action so we can do it without conscious intervention. Because when the conscious mind tries to intervene in any action, we tend to screw it up, right? The easiest way not to hit a tennis ball where you want it to go is try to think about it as you're doing it, right? The easiest way to screw a golfer up is to tell them that they're hitting really nice shots and ask them how they're doing it. Because the minute you start thinking about doing it, the conscious mind intervenes and gets in the way of a smooth action.
I think that we could all relate to that, which is so much of a reason why the process of learning how to create the impossible is beautiful, because it takes this idea of learning, which is so invisible, as you've just shared, and now it turns into something a little bit more concrete. And you have Courage You Called Your book is really, it's a how-to guide. It's truly a how-to guide for people who want to step into the place of impossible. So let's break down four skills needed for impossible, turning dreams into reality. Let's cover motivation, learning, creativity, and flow, and what their relationship is together.
So you have to understand that when we say peak performance, there's nothing fancy going on. Peak performance is nothing more or less than getting our biology to work for us rather than against us. We are all hardwired for the impossible. We are literally all hardwired for the extraordinary. We can come back to that in a little bit. But that biology, because we're just talking about optimizing our biology, it's actually a limited toolkit. There's only a certain number of things that you can optimize. And we've all heard about all the various parts, but the full list, and you hit four of the major ones. I'm going to break it down one extra step, because motivation is actually sort of a catch-all term when you're talking about it psychologically. But motivation is what gets you into the game, right? Whatever your goal is, motivation is the energy to get into the game, right? You need goals next, which is actually a subcategory in motivation. Because you need, once you're in the game, where the hell am I going, right? Your body is a goal-directed system. It needs to know where to go. So goals come next. Then you got to start layering in grit skills. This is actually, when psychologists use the term motivation, they literally mean drive. So internal drivers, things like curiosity, passion, purpose, etc. External motivators, things like money, sex, fame. They also mean goals and grit. So that's sort of like motivation is a catch-all. Sorry for the confusion on that one. But motivation is what gets us into the game. Grit allows us to continue to play after the motivation has run out. Next, you come to learning. Learning is how you continue to play, right? Whatever challenge you're moving towards, you have to keep learning along the way. And finally, especially if you're going after really high, hard goals, creativity is what comes next, because it allows you to steer. The thing about impossible challenges or any high, hard goals, you don't exactly know where you're going. That's the point. That's why they're so damn hard. If we knew how to get there, they wouldn't be so hard, right? You don't know where you're going, so you need creative problem solving, creative decision making to steer. And finally, you need flow, because flow is the turbo boost. Flow turbo boosts motivation, grit, learning, and creativity. All those things are massively amplified in flow. To put this sort of inverted, when I started doing this work on training people into flow, I just told you a second ago that flow is remarkably easy to train. But what was happening was we train up people in flow, they'd get a lot more flow in their life. That's amazing, because the uptick in performance is huge. And then the flow tap would turn off. They couldn't stabilize it. There'd be this tremendous return to baseline, right? You'd get a 70% increase, and then 6 weeks later, people were back down to like a 5 or 10% increase. It was like we didn't do the work at all and couldn't figure out what the hell was going on for a while. One of the places that Art of Impossible came from was my attempt to answer this question. What I started to realize over and over again is it had nothing to do with flow. It had to do with the fact that flow massively amplifies motivation and productivity. It massively accelerates sort of learning and creativity. But if you haven't done the hard work, if these skills aren't solid in you, amplifying them doesn't do any good. You still can't utilize them properly if you haven't sort of set them up correctly, if that makes any sense. So if you're interested in tackling impossible, the skill set you're reaching for is motivation, learning, creativity, and flow. And that's literally the biological skill set for tackling high hard challenges. It's one that is an innate on all of us. We all have those tools built into us. You just need to know how to get them to work in the right way, so they start working for you rather than against you.
When you look at individuals who go down that journey, whether they know it or don't know it, what are the most common things that trip them up? If we could walk through some of those, motivation, learning, creativity, and flow, what are some of the most common things or life circumstances or situations that we run up against that even, let's start at the beginning, that prevent us from first tapping into that motivation enough to even get started?
Yeah. So one, let's not kid ourselves. Most peak performance experts, starting with sort of Nietzsche, the first modern peak performance philosopher, all the way through like Jung, it was only the humanist psychologists in Abraham Maslow's generation who really started to change their mind about this. But for a very long time, everybody said, look, culture weighs too much for peak performance. You've got to break free of mommy and culture, right? Freud was famous for this. Mommy and culture weigh a lot, right? And you got to break free before peak performance is even possible. That's changed a lot, right? We no longer live in very, very, very restrictive Victorian era England kind of thing, where a lot of or Germany, where a lot of this thinking was sort of taking place. But this is not to say that society and culture isn't still there, but that's not where this conversation really starts. I just wanted to point that out. Motivation, so there's external motivation, money, sex, fame, those sorts of things. And the research shows that those are great. If you're interested in performance, money matters, right? Like you need to make enough money to pay your bills and have a little left over. But once you're in that situation, money stops working as a motivator. We may be interested in making more money, but if you're interested in actually like real things that you can measure, greater productivity, for example, money stops working. What we then really want to be motivated by are intrinsic drivers. And there are five major intrinsic drivers. And they're actually designed to be cultivated in an order and utilized in an order. And it starts with curiosity. Curiosity gets built upon until it becomes passion. Passion gets coupled to a cause greater than ourselves, and you get purpose. Those are the kind of first three big intrinsic motivators: curiosity, passion, purpose, and they're very biologically related. Where a lot of people go wrong, two places they go wrong. So we can send your listeners to thepassionrecipe.com. So for this whole process is laid out. It's a gift to everybody. It's the beginning of the book, but you don't have to buy the book. We just put it on an interactive PDF because so many people have asked about this. I'm just giving it away to the world in a sense. But the point is, one, it takes a little while. When you're building curiosity, the way to build passion out of curiosity is to figure out, wait, one, you want to start with all the things you're curious about because curiosity is a natural motivator, right? We get excited when we're curious. We don't have to work really hard to pay attention or to, you know, or to learn or any of those things. It comes naturally because of the neurochemistry that sits underneath curiosity. Passion is nothing more than the intersection of a couple of our curiosities. That's really what it is. We become very, very passionate about those things where three or four or five of our curiosities intersect. And neurobiologically, it's the same thing. Meaning curiosity is neurobiologically basically a little bit of norepinephrine and a little bit of dopamine, the two neurochemicals. Passion is a lot of dopamine and a lot of norepinephrine. So that's what I mean by one builds into the next, but it can take a while. You need to sort of like discover the intersection of two of your curiosities and play there. And one thing where people go wrong is they want to get there too fast. They, especially in today's world where everything has to happen overnight, and you, trust me, don't want to be like 2 years into a passion or purpose to only discover, whoa, it was only a phase. That is massively demotivating. It is hard to come back from that kind of a, oh my God, I just put 2 years into something that I'm not really into. That's a big hit. You don't want it. So people screw up there. The flip side is also they forget. So when you're trying to turn curiosity into passion and passion into purpose, if I were to ask you for an example of, for example, athletic passion, right? Really common answer is, oh, LeBron James, windmill sculling in for a dunk over, you know, some hapless defender in the NBA finals. And we think, oh, that's what athletic passion looks like. And you're right and wrong. That's what athletic passion looks like on the back end. But on the front end, it just looks like a little kid in a driveway shooting a ball through a backyard hoop and hoping, you know, the shots will fall. That's what passion looks like on the front end. And we have to remember that. So that's one quick answer at the front of the chain, a couple quick answers from the front of the process.
No, that's great. You know, I think when I'm reading through your book, one thing that comes up for me is through the process, also the resetting of expectations that people have of how things are going to go. And there's this great section in the learning portion of the book where you break down the five not so easy steps for learning almost anything. And why I love this section is that it because learning is not something that we're visually always seeing in front of us, it's hard to even understand often what the learning arc looks like. So I'd love to have you break it down because I think it would be a good teaser for our audience in terms of what it takes to really reset our expectations when we're serious about wanting to learn a topic that we want to get into.
So this is basically a system for developing, you know, some level of competence or expertise in just about anything. And it starts with the five books of learning and where people like where. So one, there's a whole, before we even get there, there's a whole section on the ROI of reading where I basically lay out for a bunch of different reasons, the fact that books are the densest form of information available on the planet. They're the most condensed form of information available. And, you know, there's a joke that's not in the book that I really like. I say it out loud because you can sort of do it tonally and it sort of works. And if I put it in the book, I knew people would hate me for it. But like, look, smart people have a word for people who don't read books. You know what that word is?
No, I don't.
Dumb.
I guess that, but I didn't want to.
Right.
Jump.
That's exactly. I mean, right. Like it's true. Books are where they keep the secrets. It's totally true. Anything. And by the way, it's one of the reasons so many successful people credit books as the secret to their success. You just learn at a certain point that you can outread the competition. And in that way, you can stay ahead of the competition if you can learn how to learn from books. And there's a particular way to follow the biology through a book. So first thing you need to know is curiosity is your great guide to learning. When we are curious, as I mentioned before, we produce the neurochemicals norepinephrine and dopamine naturally, happens automatically. These are chemicals that drive focus, they drive attention, they drive excitement, but they also amplify learning and memory. And when they're in our system, we learn more naturally, easily. We just remember that stuff. So the five books of learning basically says, look, start out when you're approaching a new subject, pick the easiest nonfiction book known to man you can, or fiction book on a subject. Let's say you want to learn about the Vatican, for example. This is the time to pick up Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. And the reason is, when it comes to learning, the things you want to start with is just the terminology. A lot of subjects are literally hidden inside the terminology, and what makes subjects so damn difficult is the foreign terminology. So the first thing you want to do is get a little exposure to the world and the terms they use in that world. And the only other thing that I tell people to pay attention to at this point is the narrative, the plot of whatever it is. So if you're trying to learn Vatican history, literally like pay a little bit of attention to the language, pay a little bit of attention to the history. And the reason you want to pay attention to the history is our brains are cause and effect machines. Our brains love narrative. We're storytelling creatures. We want to know, why did this happen? Why did this happen? Why did this happen? And the brain is always trying to figure that out, because if I know why something happens, I know how to make it happen again, or maybe how to avoid it happening again. Key survival stuff, right? So we do this all the time automatically. This is how brains are built to learn. So once you can start putting together narrative and whatever subject you're learning, you've got to always remember it's a voyage of discovery. If it's science, somebody had a question, they asked that question, then they answered that question. Somebody else had another question, they asked that question, they answered that. And that's how it goes. It's not, whatever the idea is, the process is always going to be the same. And so once you start to figure out, oh, this is the language, this is the arc, it's a gateway into the subject. And then you just proceed from there. Second book, you know, this is a popular read on the subject. So let's say you're trying to learn about intuition. This is when you would read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink. Not a very hard book on the subject, but it's fun, it's easy, and it's going to tell you, you're going to get more terminology, you're going to learn a little bit more, and it's not going to be as much work. He's a great storyteller. You don't want to start doing the hard work of learning until you've got a little bit of a foundation in the subject, which is sort of book three is for me, like, let's go back to intuition. Book three would be when you read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. That's a harder book than Blink, about the same subject. Still, you know, popular enough that it was an international bestseller. So readable by tons and tons of people, globe over, you know that. But it, denser than Blink. That's your third book. Fourth book is the first really hard technical book. This is the time you read a textbook. And then the fifth book gives you a macro, you want something that's going to give you either a look into the future or into the past. And you really, what you're trying to do in that fifth book, the fourth book is the technical hard book on the subject you're interested in. The fifth book is one that gives you a sense of, where are the boundaries of the subject? Like, where's the line where people say, okay, this stuff is real, this stuff over here is a maybe, and this stuff over here is a crazy. And I'm not saying you have to agree with their opinions, but if you're gonna disagree, know where those opinions are and why, kind of thing. And what I say about the five books is stupid. Two other things I think are important. The first is, and this is the biggest mistake people make when they're learning. Learning is an invisible process. We have built-in pattern recognition systems for the brain. That's what the brain does. That's what neurons do at a really basic idea. They link the familiar with the familiar, essentially. So your brain is going to start making connections in the material with or without you. Most people read, and if they don't understand every word they're reading, they get frustrated, they get mad, and they stop, or they start over, or they slow down, and they never got out of chapter two. And the real secret is to keep going and not care. Don't care that you're going to be feel stupid. Everybody feels stupid. The secret is to not care how you feel and do it anyways. And simply, if by just continuing to read your way through the book, your brain is going to start learning more of the vocabulary and stitching more of it together. And the three things that I said, pay attention to. If a word shows up more than, say, 3 to 5 times and you don't know it, write the definition down. And every time you encounter it, just say that definition out loud to yourself. It'll lay it in. Second of all, pay a little bit of attention to the narrative because, as I said, the brain will learn narrative automatically if you just give it the raw materials because our brain does that automatically. And finally, pay attention to those emotional wows, those moments your brain went, whoa, that was cool, whatever it is. Those moments where you're naturally curious, that's how you really learn your way through a subject. By following your curiosity through the subject, that is going to get you to expertise faster. And by the way, at the end of these 5 books, I don't think you've learned a subject. I think what you now know is enough information to start asking experts real questions about a subject. And I don't think I know enough about a subject to actually sort of write about it or speak about it in public at all until the experts themselves start saying, whoa, those are really good, interesting questions. Then I'm starting to realize, okay, now I can think a little bit inside a subject. That's the front edge of actual expertise.
Fantastic. As part of that process of what we were explaining a little bit earlier with motivation and flow and creativity, and the other one was
learning.
Yes. When it comes to the topic of creativity, so many people think that creativity is this inspiration that hits them, stroke of genius. And all of a sudden it's there. It's kind of like being a peak performer. Some people believe that people have it, some people don't. And we're defining really here very clearly in this interview that no, it's a process. And just like that's a process, creativity is a process as well too. There's an entire section, whole chapter of creativity broken down inside of the book. But high level, what are the key things that you want to address about creativity and maybe some of the myths that you want to take away?
So the myths, you just got to start with most everything people have heard about creativity is wrong. There's no creative side of the brain. Your right side isn't creative. Your left side isn't logical. In fact, you can be logically creative, right? There's no rule against that. So creativity is a whole brain activity. It's a bunch of different parts of the brain working together at once. It's actually 3 different networks. And from a really technical standpoint, it's 3, the interplay between the executive attention, the salience, and the default mode network. And what we call creativity is actually the interplay between there. And one of the hard things about creativity is it is a set of skills. There are sort of ways to train yourself to think more creatively and things like that, but it's actually a state of consciousness. It's a shift in the way the brain processes information, and that's available to all of us at all times. And there's certain really fundamental things about training creativity that are, once I explain them, you'll go, oh, that totally makes sense, but they're totally counterintuitive. I'll give you a simple example. One of the easiest ways to make yourself more creative is to be in a good mood. Why would that be the case? That's bizarre. And it turns out the more anxiety in our system, the more than you get sort of the cortisol and norepinephrine, which are predominantly anxiety in the system, the more logical and linear the brain wants to be. And we know this because we've all heard of the fight or flight response, right? When you're exposed to extreme danger, the brain says, no, this is not the time for options. We got to give you a simple choice so you can save your life. I'm going to give you 2 options. You can fight or you can flee, right? There's actually a third, you can freeze. But literally, the brain reduces all options to 3. Turns out the brain does this at any level of anxiety. The more anxiety in the system, the fewer options. Creativity is essentially what happens when the brain takes in novel information and combines it with older ideas, right, to come up with something like startling and new. The more tense we get, the less novelty the brain is going to notice in the world at the front end of the chain, and the harder time the brain is going to have finding remote connections between ideas, which is a property that's handled by a part of the brain known as the anterior cingulate cortex. And literally, the better mood we're in, the better chance the anterior cingulate cortex has of finding far-flung ideas. Second corollary, if you would like to train up creativity, if you're say you're sitting down to like do a bit of work and you need to be more creative than you are, one of the easiest ways to fix it is walk outside and look at the sky and try to look out the periphery of your eyes. Peripheral vision, if you think about fear and anxiety, the more fear and anxious we are, the more our pupils are looking straight ahead and really focused. The calmer we are, the more we're open we are to peripheral vision. Well, hey, what's going on the edges over here, right? And as a result, when we mimic peripheral vision, the brain goes, oh, look, you're looking at the things at the side of your eye. You must be calm. And it calms you down very, very quickly. So, and as a result, creativity tends to increase. These are things, this is sort of what I mean by creativity is a little bit of a state of consciousness. And if you understand sort of the neurobiology, the mechanism underneath, you can begin to work with it.
When you think about your creativity, because in the book, you're talking about breaking down actions down to things that can be done on a regular basis, be it monthly, weekly, daily, at the stage where you are right now. In it, you know, you talked about some basic sort of items, which is making sure that you are relaxed, making sure that you're not.
Yeah. Okay. So I know exactly where you're going, and you're totally there's one. If you want more creativity, the most important thing you need to do is feed your pattern recognition system. And this is one of the things that I do. You are right. By the end of the book, there's a bunch of onboarding processes, like the passion recipe, for example. But once you get all the way through it, peak performance is literally about 6 things that you should be doing every day, about 7 things you should be doing every week. And some of the things that you need to do every day are very short, take 5 minutes. And some of the things that you're doing, you can take other stuff that you're currently doing and fold them inside of it. One of the things that you actually need to make time for usually takes about a half an hour or so is you have to, and you don't have to do it every day, but you should 3-4 times a week, you want to feed your pattern recognition system. So as I pointed out, we have built-in pattern recognition systems for brains, right? This is what the brains do. And if you really want to kind of increase creativity, creativity is what happens when we take in novel information and we find connections between it and older ideas. And sort of the bigger the connection, the farther flung the connection, the bigger the neurochemical reaction, the bigger the potential insight. What happens in the modern world, especially, is we specialize, right? And the older we get, the more we try to, we learn inside the things that we're doing, but we don't actually follow our curiosity around the world and learn outside our core skill sets. For creativity, you need information that's outside your core skills because if you're learning, if I'm learning stuff about the neurobiology of flow, well, I'm already an expert in the neurobiology of flow. There's not a whole lot of energy that's going to come when I put an idea together because it's going to be really closely related to something I already know. When we're reading, about stuff that we're curious about, but it's far outside our core discipline, you don't have to worry about how it's going to connect, how it's going to help, where it's going to add up because the brain does that automatically for you. You literally just have to load the system. You have to give it the raw materials it needs to be creative. And if you're not feeding the brain this kind of information, you're not giving the brain the ingredients it needs to think creatively.
And one of those, I would just love to load from your own personal life as one example. You talk about in your past books, you've talked about highest flow activities that we can incorporate. What's your kind of go-to in the stage you are in life for the thing that you turn to on a weekly basis that is one of those things that makes up part of your adding to your flow state?
Yeah, this is a really key point, and I'm going to elaborate a little bit so you listeners can kind of grok it because it's so key. So many people, you asked earlier, right? We started with the question of like, where do people screw things up a lot? Here's a really big one. We have in flow science what people call a primary flow activity. This is, we all have one. This is whatever thing you did as a kid, where like no matter when you did it, what you were doing, you just got so lost in it, it just swallowed you whole every time, right? Really dropped you into flow. This could have been learning about dinosaurs at the Natural History Museum, or learning to sew, or playing putt-putt, or skiing, rock climbing, snowboarding, dancing to hip-hop. Take your pick, endless. As we become adults, we tend to stop doing those things. And the reason this is so problematic is, one, flow is a kind of a focusing skill. It's a very particular way of paying attention, in a sense. And like any other skill, practice makes perfect, right? So the more flow you get, the more flow you get. So my primary flow activity, one of them, is skiing. What I mean by that is, like, 90% of the time, if I go skiing, I'm going to drop into some kind of flow state along the way. And that would be, you know, a really simple example of that. And if I go skiing on Monday, my chances of dropping into flow Thursday at work are much higher because I'm training up the brain. Even better, we know flow is a massive boost to creativity and innovation, depending on whose data you're looking at and which aspects of creative problem solving you're staring at. It's a 400 to 700% boost. But a woman at Harvard, Teresa Mobley, figured out that heightened creativity, average flow states are like 90 minutes, a couple hours kind of thing. They go up and down. There's no fixed time, but that's on average what we see. And that heightened creativity will outlast the flow state by a day, maybe two. So if you're interested in increasing creativity in your life, one of the easiest things to do is actually reboot your primary flow activity. And if you want more flow in your life and all the benefits it brings to performance, leaning into your primary flow activity and sort of trying to get after it once or twice a week is really, really critical. And especially, you know, we live in some challenging times here in 2021 and 2020, 2021, and this is like one of those times where people really were panicked, were freaked out, we're trying to do everything we can to save our asses a lot, and as a result we're really often neglecting our primary flow activities. And this is really a time to lean into them, because one of the other things that happens in flow, this is, by the way, the reason that flow had such a big role in Lyme disease for me, is that when we drop into flow, flow resets the nervous system. It flushes all the stress hormones out of our system and it reboots the nervous system. And all the neural chemicals that underpin flow are also big immune system boosters. So this is why Lyme disease is essentially a nervous system gone haywire. So by resetting my nervous system, flow is really making a big difference there, and then boosting the immune system. Herb Benson at Harvard, who sort of figured out the neurobiology of this process, he's gone so far as to say he thinks this is the mechanism underneath many so-called cases of spontaneous healing. It's this very phenomenon. So, but what this tells us is, like, wow, if I can lean into my primary flow activity, I'm going to get more flow overall. I'm going to get higher creativity, all the kind of boost in well-being and overall life satisfaction and meaning that comes with flow along the way. And it's going to boost my immune system and reset my nervous system. So I'm going to calm down, which is going to have even more benefits on creativity and so forth. So it becomes a really, really positive feedback loop.
I'm going to touch back on something that you shared earlier, which is part of what you're including inside the book. And it's this idea that so many people think of peak performance or reaching for flow as sort of a bonus in life, right? Like that we're living our normal life, and then if you want to live more, then we're going after these things of peak performance and flow. But part of what you included here and really doubled down on is that you are sharing that maybe some of the mental health issues we're seeing, mental diseases we're seeing, possibly can be coming from the fact that we're not challenging ourselves. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So after 30 years of studying this stuff, I will tell you that one of the most clearest things is that every one of us, we are all hardwired for peak performance. We are built to go big. And there are a lot of scientific reasons for it, but it also turns out that not going big, not using the system the way it was designed to be used, not living up to our full potential, not going big is bad for us. In short, there are five major intrinsic motivators, right? Curiosity, passion, purpose, autonomy, and mastery, right? Autonomy means we like driving our own bus. We like to steer our own ship. And mastery, we like to get better and better at the things that we do. And when we get all that stuff right, by the way, one of the things that happens is we get more flow. And that park that information for half a second. Depression and anxiety are rampant in society right now. We're literally there at colossal levels. 1 out of 10 adults will suffer from depression or anxiety this year. Somebody kills themselves once every 12 seconds. I mean, the numbers are insane. And there are 8 known major causes of depression. 2 of them get the most kind of run. Genetics, right? I can't produce enough serotonin and that's why I'm depressed. Or trauma. Something really horrific happened and I can't get past it. And yet it turns out when you look at the science, genetics alone cannot cause depression. It's genetics and something else. And trauma, as a general rule, when most people encounter trauma, as horrible as it is, most of the time it results in what's known as post-traumatic growth, which is the exact opposite of post-traumatic stress. And it's literally, you know, it's what Hemingway meant when he said the world breaks everyone and afterwards many are stronger at the broken places, right? That's post-traumatic growth and that's more common. The other 6 major causes of depression are literally about not using our biology the way it was designed to be used. Let me give you an example. One of the most common causes of depression in the world right now is lack of meaningful work. What does lack of meaningful work actually mean? It means work that I'm not curious about, that I'm not passionate about, that isn't aligned with my values or my bigger purpose in this world, where I don't have the freedom to pursue the thing in the way I want to pursue it. And when doing the thing, I'm not doing it in any way that's like training me up and I'm getting better and I'm going towards mastery. And by the way, it doesn't produce flow. And on and on and on. We are literally built to go big, and not going big is bad for us. When we don't use our biology the way it was designed to be used, it causes anxiety and depression at epidemic proportions, apparently.
And I think coming back to how we started the interview, big can be relative to where people are in their life. Doesn't mean you have to go Elon Musk and go create the next Tesla. It could be your own version of the next mountain that you want to climb that's challenging to you on a personal level.
Yeah, I always say, look, there's capital I impossible, that which has never been done, and there's small I impossible, which is all that shit that I think is impossible for me. And The Art of Impossible may be a book that I it's lessons learned from people who have gone after capital I impossible and accomplished that. But it's meant to be used by anybody who's interested in small I impossible. And we're all hardwired for that, right? And that could be small I impossible. How do I get paid for what I love? How do I overcome deep trauma? How you pointed out, how do I overcome Lyme disease and rebuild my life after that? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is all the stuff we do. I always point out that I think the first impossible most people go after is how the hell do I kiss a girl or a boy? Right? I mean, like when you're 12 years old and trying to solve that particular puzzle, talk about an impossible.
Was that something that you went through in your own life that you
can
think
God.
Of? Was that
the first? Yeah, totally. There's a reason. It's funny. Like, you know, there's a lot of people who started out in the pickup game that like ended up learning kind of foundational human performance skills. And I always think it's because this is a challenge that like everybody really want, you know what I mean? Like we're hardwired evolutionarily to want to solve this one. So everybody gives it a go. It's one of those impossible that everybody's going to try. At some point you may give up along the way, right? That happens. But everybody pretty much gives this one a go. And most of us, one way or another, figure out how to solve it.
You have this quote from an opening of a New York Times article that you wrote. I believe it was in conjunction with your book, that you wrote about surfing and Lyme disease. And the opening quote inside of there says, "My earliest childhood belief was a sneaking suspicion that the world was more mysterious than people were letting on." At such a young age to have that sort of feeling, do you think, for anybody who's listening that has parents or people just that are curious, how can that be cultivated in young kids? Or at that young of an age, does it just happen for some and doesn't happen for others? Any thoughts?
No, I mean, so literally, like, we are biologically curious by design. Curiosity is about, oh, is that thing over there a resource that I can use? Right. That's, I mean, like, that's hardwired into every, I mean, forget every human. It's hardwired into any, almost every living thing, is kind of that bit of curiosity. It's a foundational driver in all mammals for sure. I think it can get squelched very, you know, I think it's often squelched. The intrinsic motivators are not just for adults, right? Like Montessori education, which, if you look at test scores, Montessori kids will outperform regular kids on pretty much every test you could possibly imagine. Social skills, intellectual skills, actual test-taking skills, on and on and on. And there's reasons for this. Montessori education is a very high-flow environment, and flow amplifies learning considerably. But one of the reasons it's a high-flow environment is it favors self-directed learning. We're naturally curious, and in Montessori, they let the kids drive the learning. This is, by the way, what's the big deal about AI and education? One of the big deals is right now, when you sort of batch process kids in schools, you can't, one size has to fit all, because we gotta train everybody, right? Like, how you gotta educate the nation, and it's gotta be, you know what I mean? At a certain level, it's gotta be one size fits all. But AI gives us the ability to have individually customized learning curriculums for each student. And we're going to be able to allow students to follow their curiosity through the world a little bit more than ever before. So one, I think some of this is happening naturally. And two, cultivate curiosity in kids. Questions are good things. Don't answer. You know what I mean? The wrong answer is because I said so. Or in my case, by the way, like, if you want to get a kid like me, give me a lot of because I said so's when you were a little kid. That's how you get me. I was so pissed that people kept saying, do this because I said so. And I kept going, well, why? Why would I do this? Why do I do this? Why do I do this? And nobody wanted to give me an answer. That's another way in. So I, you know what I mean? I can't tell you one way or another if there's a right way, but I can tell you that we are naturally curious, and it's very easy to kindle that fire in ourselves. Even if it's been dormant in you for, it's not, it's never, it's neurobiologically not dead. You just literally just start by making lists of, what am I curious about? And by curious, I mean, like, if you had a free weekend and time could stop, you'd like to hear a lecture or two or watch a TV show or a movie about it, maybe read a book. That's all I mean by curiosity. Start there.
It's a fantastic reminder, especially for, I've met people of all ages, 90, 80, 70, all the way down to, you know, in your 20s and your teens, who feel like they don't have that much time left. They've wasted so much time. They've squandered it. They're already down somebody else's life dream. They're following somebody else's passions that are out there, and it's pretty much over for them. And I think that what you just shared is a reminder that you can turn it all around by just tapping back into that curiosity and seeing what you naturally pay attention to.
I agree with that.
Stephen, fantastic interview. The book is out and available for everyone. And I believe there's a site set up with a bunch of bonuses and everything else like that. So in addition in the show notes, we have the link to the book, and the actual date that it's out is the 19th. But if you're hearing this beforehand, you can pre-order it. Tell us a little about the bonuses and also the Flow Research Collective, if people want to know more information.
Yeah, for sure. But they're tied together. So I am the executive director of the Flow Research Collective, and we are a peak performance neurobiology research and training organization. So we study at what we've been talking about, what's going on in the brain and the body when human beings are performing at their very best. And we do this in conjunction with neuroscientists and psychologists at places like USC and Stanford and UCLA and Imperial College London and Deloitte and et cetera. And we use what we learn to train everybody from the US Special Forces through Olympic athletes through the general public. And as I said, we train about 1,000 people a month. And The Art Impossible is a peak performance primer. It's a blueprint for everyone. And we really, like, you are capable of so much more than you know. And to really make that possible for people, we've literally bundled $1,500 worth of free peak performance tools and training, stuff that we sell normally at the Flow Research Collective, in with every copy of the book. So if you go to theartofimpossible.com, you can find all the pre-sale campaigns there. And it goes on and on. If you want to buy multiple copies of your book for, you know, yourself and everybody in your organization, we make that easy as well, and are giving away, you know, all kinds of crazy fun stuff. So check out the site. Pre-sale campaign is awesome. I tried to build the most awesome pre-sale campaign that I'd ever seen. They always kind of make me cringe a little bit, because I always feel like the reader's doing me more of a favor than I'm doing them. And so I always really wanted to create a pre-sale campaign where I could be just really proud of all the stuff we're giving away and stuff that I know that, like, you know, me and a bunch of other smart people work really hard on to make great. So we've got this one. And part of that pre-sale campaign, I just should tell you, because the only thing, it's not a tool in training, but it's a conversation you don't want to miss, is I'm going to sit down with some of the early legends of action sports. And we're going to talk about what it was like back in the 1990s. When people literally had no idea what was possible. Like, literally, we thought 70 feet was the biggest thing any could jump off of before they would die. And suddenly they jumped 75, and then it was 80, and then it was 85. And it was just like the wild, wild west of human performance. And the stories themselves are sort of fading away. And I managed to get five legends together to agree to have one conversation at one time. And I just think it's going to be a really special conversation.
Amazing. Well, the book is fantastic. And then you add the bonuses on top of that. It makes the whole thing a no-brainer. You're probably getting more than what you're spending out, for sure. So thank you for that. And our audience will absolutely check it out. I want to go back to and conclude on get your thoughts on a quote that you have heard you share in another interview. And it's on the topic of magic, which is really where you first started to learn where the impossible was real, and that with skill set and practicing, you could actually achieve these things that looked impossible on the surface. And the quote that came from the world of magic was, there's very, very little is impossible with 10 years practice. Now, on the surface, sometimes people think 10 years, oh my gosh, like, you know, that's a really long time. But we're talking about the biggest, most audacious dreams that any of us could want to bring into fruition into our life. Do you still see that quote as being true with your layers and history and years of work that you've put into the space of what's impossible and what's not?
Yes, I do. And the thing you got to always remember, and it's a good place to end, one of the reasons this stuff is so hard for people is because, first of all, the tools, they're psychological tools, they're physiological tools, they're things like, you know, peripheral vision, et cetera, et cetera. Like, they're simple. They're not sexy. They're not going to get you laid when you talk about them in bars. Nobody's going to buy you shots, you know, along the way for it. It's not, they don't work that way. That's problem A. Problem B is that peak performance works like compound interest. It is a tiny little bit today, tiny little bit tomorrow, tiny little bit the next day. And you do the same things over and over and over, month after month after month. And then you start getting exponential results. And we were literally talking in that quote. It's funny because that quote was specifically, he was talking about the hardest tricks in magic being done by the world's greatest magicians. Stuff that is so elegant on the inside and so amazing. My mentor's point was, like, literally, I don't care. I was an 11-year-old kid at the time. What he was saying to me is, I know this is this thing, this impossible trick created by the best magician on the planet, but if you put 10 years in, you too are going to be able to do it to fool people, which is the test of, like, did it work? Are you that good? Yeah, if you fooled people with the goddamn trick, it worked, right? There was a really clear benchmark for impossible. But I took that idea out of, it's true almost everywhere. And if you go in with that attitude, you're probably going to get there a hell of a lot sooner, but it gives you the patience. You're playing a long game. The brain isn't hardwired for long games, so you sort of got to like reset the way we think about certain things. And that's a useful metric.
Yeah, and you could still have fun along the process. It's not like we're waiting for this end thing 10 years down the road before we get to have a good time. The whole thing, it's hard and it's tough, but you can have fun along the process.
There is nothing more fun in life than going after and succeeding at hard things. It's the greatest pleasure. Stuart Brand once said, the only sustainable happiness is the satisfaction of a job well done. And I don't actually think happiness is different than life satisfaction and well-being and things like that. I don't think he's actually entirely wrong on that one. I think there's a lot of wisdom there.
Mm, fantastic. Stephen, pleasure to have you on the podcast. I look forward to keeping in touch and diving deep into your book. And I'm even excited to sign up for the Flow Research Collective and go through it myself. So I appreciate you coming on the Broken Brain Podcast and sharing your knowledge with our listeners.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the interest in my work. I appreciate it.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.